Christine Remington, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Justice. Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington, and I represent the state in this matter.
I just wanted to make sure your green light was on. I think you might want to raise the podium or speak closer to the microphone so that the court can hear. We think you should raise the podium. They keep changing the podium and the buttons, Ms. Christine, Ms. Remington, so that, okay, got it.
Can you hear me now?
There.
The state is asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision in this case and to make it clear that the legislature intended to change the standard required to obtain a discharge trial under Wisconsin Statute Section 98009 when it amended the statute in 2005. I would also like this court to make it clear that when the legislature intended, when the legislature amended this statute, they intended to grant the circuit court more options when dealing with a petition for discharge, that upon the paper review of the petition and the state's response and all reports and everything else that the circuit court will look at, that they would have three options, that they could deny the petition after the paper review, they could hold a hearing where they would gather limited evidence and hear argument from.
Right, okay, and the third?
From counsel, and the third would be to directly grant a discharge trial.
What about ordering an evidentiary hearing?
I think that the way that I read the statute is that the evidentiary hearing is equal to, is the same thing as a discharge trial under.
Okay, okay, that's the evidentiary hearing, discharge trial. Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes. The same, that I'm using those terms interchangeably.
Oh, which option did the trial court choose here?
If the trial court in this case denied the petition after the paper review.
Under one. It never got to the hearing under subsection 2.
It never got to the hearing on the petition.
That hearing under subsection 2 is a May hearing, discretionary.
It's discretionary. And they could go straight to the trial or they could deny it on the paper.
Right. Now, I have a question about that. The petition is a form petition, right?
Yes.
And attached to the petition was the defendant, was a Mr. Arend's expert witness. Okay. According to the trial court's decision, which is on page 117 of your brief, right?
Yes.
It said it reviewed the petition, okay, as well as the treatment progress report. Well, that wasn't in the petition.
The treatment progress report? I was not.
A reexamination report by Dr. Schmidt, which the state views as supportive of it, right?
Yes.
As well as Dr. Fields, which is the, okay. So if it was under the first subsection of just the pleading, how does it look at the treatment progress report and the reexamination report? Because I agree, or I think I agree, that those are on in the record because they're filed with the court, so the court can look at them. But I don't see how it comes under one, which is just looking at the petition.
My reading of one is that they can look at all of this evidence, especially considering that the standard in order to grant a discharge trial is the court will have to consider if anything has changed in the person's condition. And to only look at the petition and the reexamination reports, they wouldn't know what had been presented in the original.
Okay, well then how does number one differ from number two, which says under the statute that, see if I can find the statute, it's supposed to be on page 8 of your brief, if my notes are right. Under one, may petition, deny the petition without a hearing, unless the petition alleges facts, doesn't say anything about anything else. Then it says, that you have to review, under two, the court has to review the petition within 30 days. And they did here. That's no question.
Yes.
And under two, it says may hold a hearing. Did the court hold a hearing here?
It did not.
It did not. And to determine if it contains facts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it can go beyond the petition under two and may hold a hearing. Might not have to hold a hearing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But under this next sentence, it says, in determining under this subsection, so we're going beyond the petition in this subsection, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The court shall consider current or past reports, which they did here.
Yes.
So it looks to me like they did sub two. But it also says relevant facts in the petition. They did that too, I assume. It doesn't say that, but I assume that. State's written response. Did the state have a written response?
I don't believe so in this case.
Okay. What about arguments of counsel?
There were no arguments of counsel because there was no hearing held on.
Okay, so there was no opportunity. So how do you get around the fact that the statute says the court has to consider, shall consider?
I read that subsection as saying that the court shall consider all of those things on paper when determining whether to hold the hearing under the shall review the petition within 30 days and may hold a hearing. I read that second sentence as saying that they can consider when determining whether to hold the hearing, they can consider the current and past reports.
Okay, I'm going to ask a question I asked you before. Has the trial court therefore finished its proceeding under two here? In this case, has the trial court finished what it had to do under two and made a decision, and its decision was it didn't have to go on to three?
I believe so, yes, that they reviewed the petition and all the current and past reports and under the may hold a hearing chose that it may not, wouldn't hold a hearing.
Yeah, the state's position is on the basis of the one and two that the trial court did, that the trial court did not have to have an evidentiary or trial hearing.
Yes, it's the state's position that may means that they can deny it on the paper, that they could have held a non-evidentiary or a limited evidentiary hearing just to gather more information, maybe talk to some experts, maybe get argument from counsel, but then...
And they didn't have to allow counsel to argue. They didn't want to. That's your position.
That's my position, yes, is that, okay, that on this paper review they don't have to, but then they could have held a hearing and had argument from counsel, and then at that hearing decided whether or not to hold a discharge
under two.
Or an evidentiary hearing under three, that shall hold a hearing within 90 days on the determination of...
Your position is what the trial court satisfied one and two and reached the right conclusion that it didn't have to do number three.
That is my position.
And that the Court of Appeals said on the basis of one and two they had to do three.
Yes, the Court of Appeals decision seems to skip past that hearing where they would take argument from counsel and that have a limited evidentiary hearing where they could look at the petition and hear argument and then decide whether or not a discharge trial would be granted. It seemed like the Court of Appeals decision just skipped over that step and said, based on paper review of all of these things, he should get a discharge trial.
Ms. Remington, I've got a question that gives me some concern. Judge Fiorenza, when he enters his order in this case, talks in terms of not finding probable cause. Yet I understand the state's position is, hey, the statutes were changed. Probable cause determinations are no longer required. How do you get around what the judge did and the position he took? And as you know, the Court of Appeals also looked at and relied on the old probable cause cases.
Yes, I think that that's one of the reasons why we're here, and that I think that there needs to be more clarity as to what the legislature intended in this case, or when they amended the statute, because I think circuit courts are confused about whether or not the probable cause standard still exists, or whether it's something different, and if it's something different, what exactly it is, because the language of the statute isn't.
And your position is the probable cause standard is gone, right?
Yes, that is my position.
How do you get there? How do you get there?
I get there based on the progression of the statute itself, that the statute used to say the courts would have hold a probable cause hearing on the petition and determine whether or not probable cause existed. That mechanism is no longer in the statute. They took out all references to the phrase probable cause, and the legislature also made it so that instead of having to hold that probable cause hearing upon receiving every petition, they could do this paper review without holding the actual hearing.
Is there any statutory history that supports your position?
There's nothing that I've found that explains exactly why they took the language out. But my argument is that by the act of taking that language out, they intended to change it from probable cause, that they wouldn't have gone through the effort to take out those two words if they meant to leave it probable cause, because there would have been no reason to.
Well, is it your position then that the hearing, not the evidentiary trial on whether he ought to be discharged, but the hearing that is possible under sub 2 is really a discretionary determination by the trial court?
That is my position, and that's based on the text of sub 2, where it says the court shall review the petition within 30 days and may hold a hearing. That I read that may as being a discretionary decision where the circuit court can determine, based on the paper review, whether or not to hold that hearing.
And what's the standard that you think the circuit court is to exercise its discretion under if it determines it wants to gather more information than what it already has presented?
That's based on the text of this statute. It says that the court should use the standard of that a court or jury may conclude that the person does not meet criteria for commitment as a sexually violent person. In my brief, I argue that that is equivalent to a preponderance of the evidence standard, not based on the text of this subsection, but more taking those words and trying to figure out what the legislature intended, having abandoned probable cause as the standard, that and putting these words in there, what that means, and giving circuit courts more guidance about what that means, because circuit courts don't really understand, that's a standard they don't have for anything else, where the court or jury may conclude that the person does not meet criteria.
And that's a different hearing than I'm trying to focus on. The old statute had a probable cause hearing before you got to the hearing on whether there should be some form of release, either outright or supervised release. I was trying to focus on there, and I agree with you, I think there's discretion to hold a hearing. But whenever a trial court exercises its discretion, we'd like to know what are the standards it's applying, not just arbitrary, yeah, I'm going to give you a hearing, or no, I'm not going to give you a hearing. And that's where I am. I look at this last sentence in sub 2, really, if the court were to review the materials on a paper review and find that a reasonable jury could conclude the person does not meet the criteria for commitment, well, that's all the way to the evidentiary trial. That's a trial on the merits of the petition, correct?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, and I'm more worried about the in-between standard.
The standard is determining whether or not to gather more information.
Exactly. That's the standard that I'm a little bit at a loss for. So, you know, I see the discretionary words, and they fit what we're used to, but I don't know what the standard is. Before, the standard was probable cause, right?
In order to have this yeah. I understand what you're asking.
Okay.
I guess I would say that it's similar. I have a harder time defining that standard than I do defining standard in determining the discharge trial itself. But I think that it is, maybe it's a similar standard as far as like a summary judgment motion where the court takes all the evidence and decides, is there still even an issue? And if there's an issue, then they've had the hearing to try and flesh out, there's something I don't understand here, or there's something that's not completely clear to me here, that they could then hold the oral argument hearing or what.
So if the court believes the information presented is incomplete for him or her to make a decision about whether to go on to the next step?
That's my position, yeah, that it's not, I mean, I guess that's not as clear as one of the things I'm at, or like the preponderance of the evidence, but it's more of the court just needs more information or doesn't think something's clear or just wants to hear from the parties.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Ms. Remington, I'd like to draw your attention to option two, as you've stated it, what I've been referring to in my inner chambers memo as an intermediary hearing.
Okay.
The subsection 2 has a very finite list of those things that the court shall consider in making its conclusion. It seems to me you're suggesting that there would be additional items that the court could consider at option 2, as you've called it, and at the intermediary hearing, as I've been referring to it.
Yes, I believe that the circuit court has a lot of discretion, I think, on the paper review and in determining whether to hold the intermediate hearing. And my position is that the more information they look at that stage, the better. And especially given that the standard is whether the person's condition has changed since their original commitment, I think that original commitment, the trial and the reports from that point are extremely relevant to the decision, because if the reports and discharge are arguing for the same, or saying he doesn't meet criteria because of the same reasons that were argued to the jury originally, that wouldn't meet the standard.
So it seems to me you're kind of inferring in there an additional matter that the court could consider and all other relevant evidence.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, that I think that the circuit court shouldn't be limited to this finite list of things that they can consider, because...
How do you reconcile that interpretation, though, with the use of the word conclusion at the end of that sentence? In other words, in determining, this is subsection 2, in determining under this subsection whether facts exist that might warrant such a conclusion. Now, that conclusion seems to me, and if you have a different view, I'd be interested in hearing about it. That conclusion seems to be going to the ultimate determination of whatever standard is going to be wind up being applied here, probable cause, or however it'll be expressed. Doesn't it seem to be that that's a finite list of factors that the court is to consider? In other words, it doesn't say these are the factors the court is to consider in an in-camera inspection to determine whether or not to hold an intermediary hearing or option 2.
The way I read that sentence is that the court must consider all of those things,
right,
because the legislature used the word shall. I guess I read that as being those things that the bare minimum that they have to do in order to make their decision, but that I read it as being open to allowing the court to consider other things. I mean, often I think when a circuit court judge is making this decision, it might be the same circuit court judge who committed the person in the first place, and they might not need to review any of the original commitment information because they will remember it because they presided over that. So that would be something that, of course, would be in their head, and they would not be able to avoid considering, but this, I view this list as the things that must be considered at this stage.
Then that comes back to a question that the Chief Justice asked you earlier. What if there was no argument of counsel, as there was not here? How could the court ever make that option one decision without considering something that the legislature says that the court shall consider? In other words, there was no argument of counsel here, and the trial court denied the petition. So the court obviously, by definition, did not consider argument of counsel.
Oh, okay. I see what you're asking there. Then that... because they would be denying it on the paper where,
right,
there wouldn't be any argument. I guess maybe...
Well, there could be argument.
There could be argument in that situation because there is the paper, the form petition, which would have some statements alleging that the person is no longer dangerous. And in the state's response, they could be making some argument. I guess
Remington, doesn't it say, and any supporting documentation, which could include argument of counsel?
Well, yeah, that's true. But when I was reading arguments of counsel originally, I was reading it as oral arguments of counsel, but I do think that there are other ways that counsel could be arguing in the supporting documentation.
Which brings me back to the question that we had just started talking about a few seconds ago, which is, if there was no argument of counsel, how could the court have fulfilled its obligation here under the prescription that it must consider arguments of counsel?
Given sub 2?
Yes.
I think I would say in this case that because the court considered the petition and the language of the petition, that included arguments of...
And apparently the accompanying documentation.
Yes, that's what my position would be. Is
there was no argument here. The only accompanying documentation was Dr. Fields' expert testimony. You know, the state has problems because, and I'm sympathetic both to the state and the defendant, shouldn't say defendant, but to Mr. Ahrens, because the statute looks as if it's setting up this definite procedure, and that was the goal here of the legislature. Set it up, touch all these bases, and then you wind up with a decision, and it's clear and simple. And it tried to simplify statutes that had a number of different hearings by depending on who filed the petition, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is one is a pleading statute, subsection 1.
Yes.
And it only talks about when the court shall deny the petition. It doesn't talk about when the court shall grant the petition. Sub 2 talks about a hearing, which is beyond the petition. This court did not have a hearing here. The trial court did not have a hearing, as we know a hearing. Doesn't mean everybody had to come, but it didn't say invite all the materials. It didn't invite counsel, etc. So what the court did here, the trial court did here, is it said, I'm going beyond the pleadings. I've gone beyond sub 1. And I'm going to consider stuff in my file. Right?
Yes.
No hearing. I'm going to consider stuff in my file. And after I consider the two stuffs in my file, which are the two reports, right? Mm-hmm. It then said, I'm denying. Right? And nothing in this statute is written says that's what the court can do. It either goes, statute is written, says, either look at the pleading or you have a hearing if you need more information. It doesn't say you can do it without a hearing.
Under sub 1, you're saying that he would only, the court would have only been allowed to look at the petition.
That's what it says.
Yeah.
Shall deny the petition unless the petition alleges facts. That's all it is. It's a pleading statute. I mean, we can interpret it differently and say it doesn't make any sense, but as written. And then 2, they can hold a hearing. Then, if they hold a hearing, then they have to consider the past reports, blah, 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 and it's all listed. But he didn't do that. Question is, can he have an intermediate? Where does it fit between 1 and 2?
An intermediate where he looks at more, what looks
right.
at paper, but
right.
and doesn't hold a hearing.
It doesn't have a hearing.
And I think there should be that option for circuit courts, given...
I gathered that.
but given that circuit yeah. courts should be able to exercise their discretion and shouldn't be limited by only looking at the petition.
Right. And it's in the file.
Right?
Part of the record, and you want courts to look at whatever they can to make a sensible decision. But that's what happened here, as I understand this record.
Yes, I agree. And I think that in this case, definitely the circuit court didn't seem to understand what they were supposed to do under the statute because, I mean, he used the term probable cause in the order and said...
But you want to affirm them, counsel. They didn't know what they were doing, and then you want to affirm them on a one-pager that doesn't explain anything if they're supposed to exercise discretion.
I do think that the circuit court decision should be affirmed because I think the overall conclusion is the correct conclusion to reach. I mean, maybe a remand and allow the circuit court, give the circuit court guidance to determine what it should do based on the paper review, when it should decide. I mean, maybe that would be a better way to go in this case because the circuit court was so confused. But the reason why I argue for affirming the circuit court is that I believe that the ultimate conclusion that this patient wasn't entitled to a discharge trial was the correct conclusion.
And your brief says that, and I appreciate that.
Ms. Remington, I guess this is what troubles me. The legislature has listed all of these things that the court shall consider. Does the court sui sponte have to do that? Does the court have to go out and seek those things? Or is there some obligation on the part of the petitioner or on the part of the state to present those things? Where is the obligation here? Is it on the circuit judge?
Well, I think in the situation of these things that it shall consider the current and past reports and relevant facts in the petition and the state's written response, all of those things should already be included in the court file. I guess I'm not sure whose duty it is to get them there, but I mean, most of the current and past reports would be filed probably with either the patient when he files the petition or with the state.
Well, if it's important for us to give guidance to circuit judges, isn't that a key part of the guidance we should be giving them? Judge, you got to go out and get all this stuff, or judge, you have to look at what's presented by the petitioner or by the respondent, by the state?
But does the judge have the obligation to
seek it out?
Have a hearing, then whoever shows up and whatever they do. I don't know that.
I'm asking what the state's position is. I don't know it either. It's your problem.
Let's hope we meet in conference. It's turn, Remington, and your red light's on. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Leonard Kaczynski, representing the respondent appellant, Daniel Lorenz. Mr. Kaczynski.
May it please the court, Mr. Daniel Lorenz is presently at Sandridge Correctional Institution. He's 23 years old as of today. He was found delinquent on a second-degree sexual assault with use of force in the year 2000 and placed in various juvenile institutions. And then was scheduled for release on his 18th birthday. However, the state filed a 980 petition shortly before that. He was committed by a jury in Washington County. And at the time of his original trial, he was examined. There was a special purpose examination performed by Dr. Michael Hagan before he was committed that provided the probable cause for the 980 petition in the first place. And then there was other examination by Susan Sockensmeyer and Anthony Jurek on behalf of the state, finding that Mr. Ahrens had an antisocial personality disorder that predisposed him to commit sexually violent offenses. At the trial, the respondent had Dr. Michael Kotkin and also Michael Caldwell that testified that Mr. Ahrens did not have a predisposing condition for Chapter 980. He was committed, placed in Sandridge. He filed a petition on August 10th of 2005, approximately 6 months after his commitment. The default petition was just denied 6 days later by then-Judge Ziegler. Then there was a new examination report, as is periodically done in Chapter 980 cases, by a doctor. I can never pronounce his name correctly, but I think it's Harrismaw, Harrismyw, and a treatment progress report, which is also filed periodically by Sandridge. He had counsel appointed for him, Samuel Benedict, who in turn did what most counsel do in these post-conviction 980 cases, requested appointment of a psychologist to produce an independent report on Mr. Ahrens. So Sheila Fields conducted that examination, filed the report, and as I think has been noted, she found there were three reasons why Mr. Ahrens was no longer a sexually violent person that did not exist at the time of his commitment in January of 2005. And those were, first of all, that because his behavior since that time had been relatively uneventful in terms of institutional behavior, that was significant because it went against the diagnosis that he had an antisocial behavior. Second of all, he had a lower PCLR score, which is a score the psychologists use to try to determine somebody's degree of psychopathy, which is a general form of antisocial disorder in a more extreme form. And finally, there had been new research done on the recidivism risk of juvenile-only sexual offenders by Michael Caldwell that had occurred since the time of the trial in 2005. And based on all of those and her review of progress that Mr. Ahrens had made in treatment, she concluded that he did not meet the criteria anymore for having a predisposing psychological condition, and therefore that he should be discharged.
Counsel, is there a right to counsel whenever a confined Chapter 980 person wants to petition for release? I was looking in this. I know there is when a petition is filed to put on a Chapter 980 supervision, there's a right to counsel set on the statute. But that statute says, except as provided in 980.09. But then I read 980.09, doesn't say a word about right to counsel. And my question is, if there's, once you get to the trial, certainly there's a right to counsel, but I'm going back to, does he have a right to counsel pre-filing of the petition for release? And if you know, can you tell me where you find that?
Whenever a treatment team and reexamination report is filed with the trial court, there's blocks to check on the petition for appointment of counsel and for an independent psychological examination. So at that point, the individual can request counsel, and I believe he did in this point. The matter was referred to the State Public Defender's Office for appointment of counsel, and they appointed Samuel Benedict.
Well, okay.
It's kind of
you're saying it just is apparent because it's on the form that everybody uses. So you can check if you want counsel appointed and he asks for counsel, but what if he doesn't check? Maybe he doesn't like lawyers. He thinks they haven't been much help to him, and so he doesn't check that box and he files his own petition. That's certainly a possibility if you're just going to get it out of the form. Then the state doesn't have any obligation to affirmatively appoint counsel. I'm having problems with that, and I'll tell you why. It's because the second sentence in 980.09 says the court shall consider, and one of the things is arguments of counsel. Well, if you don't have an affirmative obligation for the state to have appointed your counsel and you haven't selected it yourself on the form, then how does that fit in with the statute? So that's what's kind of bugging me a little bit.
The way it does, we generally end up, just because a 980 person decides to file a petition for discharge, which they can file at any time, that doesn't mean they're entitled to counsel every time that they do that.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get to.
Yeah, but the state always has counsel.
Right.
The state always has counsel, so you can have arguments by counsel. You can also read that if you represent yourself, you are your own counsel, and that you have the right to make an argument. So.
Mr. Kaczynski, could I ask you some questions? You've been doing this work for a while.
Yes, I have.
So you're undoubtedly familiar with the procedure under the old law and under the new law, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Is it fair to say that under the old law, when the secretary gave approval, a petition could be filed by the person who'd been committed, and that would go directly to a discharge trial?
If there was secretary approval, yes, that didn't happen very often.
Okay, didn't happen very often. Now, there was, under the old law, when there was periodic review, wasn't the person who was committed informed that they had the right?
Yes, that's this, what's commonly referred to as a default petition for discharge, such as Pollock, which happened to be my case when I had it at the, I think the appellate level.
Suppose they had the right to review, but they didn't file a petition. Did they get a hearing? Did they get a default hearing?
Under the old law, if they didn't affirmatively waive the right to a discharge review, then there was at least a paper review by the judge. Under the new petition, or under the new law, I don't see in there a right to...
I understand. Tell me if I'm wrong. I could be wrong. I often... my colleagues say I'm often wrong. It was my understanding that in a default situation, an individual would have the right to a hearing just by not waiving the right to a hearing.
Right.
Okay. And therefore, if there was the right to a hearing just by default, you really didn't have to allege anything to get that hearing. Isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, therefore, for example, taking this petition right here, in this case, it talks about, I am no longer more likely than not to commit an act of sexual violence because blah, blah, blah. And then it cites the Dr. Fields report. It's attached. So that would be the facts here. But under the old law, there wouldn't even have to be a reference to Dr. Fields, would there?
Correct.
Okay. So, in changing the law, the legislature required some sort of facts to be alleged to entitle the individual to a hearing.
That's correct. I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. Now, if adequate facts are alleged, is the person entitled, in fact, to a hearing? Or can that just be dispensed with in chambers?
Under the new statute, is that your question?
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that the issue in this case?
Yeah, it is, Your Honor. It is. And I believe that if adequate facts are alleged, basically I think of the probable cause standards just to what existed under prior law, that the individuals were entitled to a trial on the issue of discharge. The state would have to prove by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that he was a sexually violent person, which is a lower burden than they did at the initial commitment trial.
So is it your position that under one, there are enough facts alleged in that petition that the trial court had to automatically, I shouldn't say automatically, trial court had to say on the basis of the pleading, you get a trial on the discharge?
No.
Okay, why not?
If the facts alleged are just totally inadequate.
Okay, but if the facts are adequate. Okay.
Then I believe the court can look not just at the report that was filed, but can also consider other proceedings that had occurred earlier in the case, earlier psychological reports.
Moved into subsection 2?
Correct. I think subsection 1 is just a means of denying totally inadequate cases.
Because it doesn't talk about granting. It
right.
just talks about denial.
Right.
So unless the court was prepared to deny it on the basis of that, the court could go further. Where do you see authority to look at other reports without a hearing?
The authority would come in subsection 2 and it refers to other documentation.
No, but it says under this subsection, and subsection 2 only refers to a hearing. I'm just looking at
right.
the plain language. I mean, I'm
right.
not saying that that makes sense, but just
correct.
Looking at the language of this statute.
I would think that, for example, in this particular case where you have an expert opinion favoring discharge, that the trial judge would then look at the other documentation in the file. The judge would have the discretion to just grant it without asking for any more input, or the judge could ask for input from the state and from lawyers appointed for the respondent and ask them if they believe that there's sufficient facts based on the report that's just been filed by the respondent plus the previous activity in the case to warrant a trial.
Is this case a stage two case that stage two has been satisfied in your opinion?
In my opinion, stage two was engaged in by the judge, but I don't think the requirements of the statute were complied with because based upon all there wasn't any input from counsel, and based on all the facts in the record.
That's reaching the wrong result, in your opinion. But,
right.
I mean, I just want to procedurally. See, we can get to whether the right result was reached, but procedurally, what should the trial court have done here?
I believe the trial court should have either scheduled a hearing or, at an absolute minimum, request written input from attorneys from the state and attorneys for the respondent.
Counsel, why do you believe that? We're still in sub two, so we're looking at this discretionary hearing. And what you're saying is somewhat toward what I was asking opposing counsel about. What kind of a standard does the trial court have to operate under when it decides if it's going to gather more information before it decides whether it's going to send it on for an evidentiary hearing on the merits of the petition? And why do you think in this case the trial court needed to have this intermediary hearing?
Well, the original petition that was filed for discharge by Aaron's contained a favorable expert opinion, and therefore I think the court really didn't have to gather information so much as review information that was already in the record and see if there was any arguments that counsel wanted to make on that if the court was considering denying it without a hearing. So typically the court file at the point that Aaron's petition was filed, and it's quite typical otherwise, the court file would have already consisted of treatment team reports that are filed on a yearly basis by Sandridge. It would have consisted of their reexaminations. So the court didn't really have to gather information. In fact, if they ordered a psychological examination, I'd never know one that would get done within the 30-day time frame to make a decision.
Counsel, it isn't totally clear to me. Are you asserting that the circuit court erred because of failure to hold a sub-3 evidentiary hearing or a sub-2 evidentiary hearing? What are you complaining about?
I think the court erred in both of those respects, in not in denying it without getting any further input. And in fact, if the court had done that, I think they may have come to a different decision. But I think ultimately, just based on the record that exists, that was before the court at that time, that they should have granted the hearing on or trial on discharge.
And so when I say, just like when the state started its argument, the state said evidentiary hearing is the discharge trial. That's the sub-3. And
right.
That's what you're focusing on then? Is that your complaint? Or?
Correct. I believe Aaron's entitled to, on the basis of the records, entitled to a trial on subsection 3.
And that's what the Court of Appeals said. And that's the subject of this review. Now, I have a question for you. I think it's arguable, maybe you will agree or not, that subsection 2 sets forth the standard for the trial court to determine whether it will hold a hearing. It seems to me that the court may hold a hearing when it thinks it needs a hearing to determine whether it, and it must be the petition, contains facts from which the court or jury may conclude that the person doesn't meet the criteria. That means that they'll hold a hearing if the petition contains facts that would indicate that the person can be discharged. because the first one deals with the subsection 1 deals with denial. This is if the court thinks it might grant it. That's how I read it.
I think the court could either grant the petition and schedule a trial, or correct. Or if the court thought it was necessary or useful, invite arguments from counsel either in the court or in writing as to whether or not the evidence in the record was sufficient to warrant a trial.
And does that run to your reading of subsection 2, indicating the list of items that the trial court shall consider?
Correct. Especially, I think, as you pointed out, Your Honor, the supporting documentation is a pretty broad category of information.
And we haven't quite talked, you and I haven't talked about it, you haven't talked about it in response to any of the other questions, and I want to ask you, is it consistent with your reading of subsection 2 that at option 1, the paper review, or I consider it an in-camera review, even though it doesn't say that, likely it's going to happen there, that the court shall consider those factors, or those items, including arguments of counsel, if any, at option 1, the paper review in-camera stage?
No, at the stage 1, the court can simply deny it if the petition in and of itself really alleges nothing, which would typically be some committee that just someone doesn't like being at Sand Ridge or the Resource Center files a piece of paper saying I want out.
But say the trial court judge, doesn't that kind of put the trial court judge as a hostage to what the petitioner chooses to put in the petition? Because a lot of these are pro se. And they are the kind of people, you know, they are the kind of petitions that you're talking about. But it seems to me that a diligent judge, a good judge, would say, all right, this person hasn't included, may not have included relevant information in their petition itself. I want to know what's really going on. I want to open these sealed envelopes containing all of the confidential reports. Doesn't it seem to you that subsection 2, those factors, would give the court authorization to do that, as opposed to taking a flyer and saying, gee, I'm going to schedule a hearing for an hour, and I'm going to get the lawyers here, and I'm going to get everybody here, I'm going to get the, you know, the petitioner here. Doesn't that seem more consistent with what everyone seems to be conceding, the legislative purpose of sort of giving the circuit court a little more flexibility here?
Correct. The court could, if it got a petition just saying, basically, I feel I'm better, you know, signed by my respondent, the court certainly could look at the record in the case, which would consist of these annual reexaminations and the treatment team reports.
Why wouldn't it be what's listed out in subsection 2, though? Shall consider any current or past reports, the written response, arguments of counsel, and any supporting documentation. Why isn't it right there?
I don't know why the legislature didn't do it that way.
I'm asking you,
sure.
How do you know they did? I mean, it seems to be saying this is what the trial court shall consider. That's my question to you.
I think if the trial court, you know, if it's more than just a bare petition that says I feel I'm better and has some, by reference, a supporting expert opinion, the court's obligated to go through the consideration of the entire file.
But that's a different question, because by definition, under your hypothetical, there is a supporting document, the favorable doctor's report, and so reasonable minds could argue, well, it seems pretty blatant, it seems pretty clear that that would serve as a probable cause, again, whatever term is going to wind up being the product of this, as pretty reasonable probable cause that the person has made the requisite showing.
In most cases, there was, of course, the Combs decision that said that you had to allege, you know, something more than simply disagreeing with the conclusions of the original commitment trial, which I think, you know, this one was different in that respect. So we have Combs and Cruz that say if you just simply disagree with the results of the commitment trial, that's not enough, even if an expert says he doesn't qualify.
Sure. But okay, so that's, thank you.
Counsel, do you think the language of the statutes, let me just focus on one, and then I'm going to focus on two, and then three, because this is in part a statutory interpretation case. Do you think the language of sub one is ambiguous? Should we be reading something in there, or is the language clear?
I think there's some ambiguity in subsection 1 in that it doesn't really indicate what are sufficient facts that would warrant a hearing or warrant a court simply dismissing it without a hearing. So in that respect, you have to look, I think, to primarily the case law that existed prior to the enactment of Act 434.
Other than what constitutes sufficient facts, do you think the language and some, do you have any other problem with it being plain language that is a clear and unambiguous statute?
Other than that particular factor, yes.
Well, it doesn't say what the court should do to grant the petition. It only deals with denial, so there's a missing element right on the face of it. That, I think, is the question. Is there a missing element? One way of looking at sub 1 is what I would say to myself, a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. That, you know, this is the sufficiency of stating a claim. And if that's what sub 1 is, then you don't get to this missing part. That's in part why I'm asking the question. I mean, should we be saying, oh, let's read something else into sub 1?
I think the analogy to dismissal for failure to state a claim is a pretty good one. In interpreting the statute in such a way that it makes sense, which of course courts are obligated to do if there is any ambiguity whatsoever, that they made a logical statutory scheme for judges to assess cases like this.
I mean, we can say, hey, the legislature must have forgotten about saying something about granting in sub 1, or we can say, the legislature intended what it meant to say. And that is just talk about denial. What's your position?
I agree there's an ambiguity there as to how you get from and how you justify a denial without a hearing as opposed to going further and considering not only the petition but the entire court file that existed up to that point in determining whether there's enough evidence to go to stage 3 and have a trial on discharge in front of either a judge or a six-person jury.
What constitutes the facts, as you
Correct.
Said? That's the ambiguity. What
Correct.
Constitutes the facts? Could he have denied on the basis of just this petition?
Our position is absolutely not.
But he have to grant on the basis of this petition?
I would say on the petition itself, no. I think you're certainly obligated to look at the entire court record for situations such as Combs and other cases.
Now in subsection 2?
Correct.
And that's a grant section?
Correct.
I don't see how the court, if it has a sufficient petition facially, can simply avoid any hearing of any kind, either under 2 or 3, just in-house, in ex parte. I just don't see how I can do that.
I would agree. I think that it's pretty clear if you've got a sufficient petition, and those are generally, if they've got a sufficient petition, they'll almost always have counsel appointed at that point that arranged for the psychologist to do the independent exam. So there certainly would be counsel in place familiar with the case on the part of the respondent. The state has a pretty specialized prosecution system for 980 cases, can get somebody in there that knows this stuff, and they can get the hearing within the 30-day time frame and make a decision whether there should or should not be a discharge trial.
Mr. Kaczynski, I've heard you several times talk about probable cause, talk about the cases like Holmes, Fowler, that relate to probable cause. Didn't the legislature eliminate the references to probable cause? Isn't that significant?
It changed, they got rid of those words, but I think the procedure that's set up for, in subsection 2 basically amounts to that when you say situation from which a jury or a judge could find a person who is no longer a sexually violent person. I don't think it amounts to a requirement for the trial court to find this preponderance of the evidence. I think for a court to do that before there's even an adversarial fact-finding hearing is just a usurpation of the person's right to a decision by a tribunal.
So you think that probable cause is there in regard to subsection 2?
Essentially, yes. Not the words, but the basic concept, yes.
Like a preliminary hearing, probable cause?
I believe it's just like it was under the prior case law, you know, with
Fowler?
Fowler, yes. I think you have to, obviously, I think any respondent needs a favorable expert opinion and an absolute minimum before you get to a trial. It's not just the person saying, I'm no longer a sexually violent person. And in that sense, probable cause in the 980 case is a bit different than in other types of cases.
So it's a plausibility, not a credibility determination by the trial court?
I would agree.
That's what your position is. The state's position is that the legislature wanted to tighten up and not give respondents, such as Mr. Wendt, as much leeway in hearings, and that the court is a gatekeeper, and the court should look for preponderance of the evidence and test, at least lightly test, if I understand the state, the expert testimony or expert reports to see if they withstand higher scrutiny than maybe was given before, because the state wants us to overturn Fowler, if I understand their position, right?
Correct. That's their position. There was nothing in the legislative note that was attached to this when Act 434 was passed that even talked about discharge trials.
Yeah, if I understand it, your position in your brief, which really goes to the merits of these reports and balancing it with probable cause, the position, you're not complaining that he didn't get what he was entitled to under 2. You're really complaining that everything on this record shows that he should get a sub-3 hearing.
Yes.
And if I understand the state's position, too, is that subsection 2 has been satisfied here. Let's get to the main event of, you know, what was the standard of probable cause or preponderance of evidence to get to 3. You're not complaining that he didn't hear you. You're not really complaining about that, are you? I mean, if you have to, you'll complain about it. You'll take a win on that basis. I understand that. But, I mean, that's not the essence of your brief.
Correct.
The essence of your brief is on the basis of this record, using probable cause, your client should get a sub-3 evidentiary hearing or trial.
Correct.
Okay. And the state's position is they did fine under 2. May have some problems, but when you look at the whole thing, preponderance of the evidence, credibility, testing, doesn't get an evidentiary hearing. Isn't that the way you differ?
I believe so, yes. And my position is the gatekeeper function exists only in the subsection 1, keeping out the petitions that have no expert support.
Okay. And then you make a decision on probable cause.
Right.
However you do it, with a hearing, without a hearing, on the paper record itself.
Yes.
That's how I understood your brief. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mrs. Remington.
I'd like to start out talking about sub 1, or what we're calling sub 1 at least, and talking about the standard.
It's not numbered, but we all call them.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
That's why I said that. But we were talking about the standard that would apply at sub 1. And Justice Bradley said maybe failure to state a claim. I would also say that it could be similar to the Bentley standard in a post-conviction motion, where the court can look at whether it alleges sufficient facts, whether it only presents conclusory allegations, or whether the record shows he's not entitled to relief. And the third part about the record showing he's not entitled to relief could allow a circuit court at the sub one phase to look at the record and to say, to look at these other things that are included. And while that's not written into the text of sub one, I think that that would be a fair reading of what the legislature intended under sub one.
So you maybe in this case it never got to two. Is that your position?
It's hard to know what the circuit court did in this case, given what, they, what we have. I think that the court could have done it without getting to sub two, but could have, under sub one, looked at all of the paper and looked at all of that, and sub two would have been where he would have gone if he wanted to hold that hearing and hear arguments from counsel and hear all of, gather even more information.
So I don't understand how counsel, I don't understand how the court is able to discern deficiencies in the reports of either side without holding a hearing. Yeah, under the old law, there was almost an automatic hearing. You didn't have to do anything to get the hearing. It's a default hearing. Here, the law says, as I read it, you have to plead, in effect, facts that a judge or jury can conclude the situation has changed. So that's different. As I read this, if there is then a hearing under sub 2, the court can weigh these things and say, yes, you pled enough to get a hearing, but look, there are four other reports here, and there's some holes in your report, and I'm not going to go to a final discharge hearing.
Are you saying that the court could decide
at a hearing? But I mean, what you seem to be saying is that the court can say, we are not going to go forward in this matter, even though the pleadings are sufficient. Because just in my office, I looked at these papers, and there isn't enough.
I think that reading the text of the statute, the legislature has granted circuit courts more ability to weed out petitions without holding a hearing. I mean, as you said, it used to be a default hearing under the probable cause, and it was a probable cause hearing, and that's done away with under this statute. I think that the legislature decided that it should be harder for petitioners to get to that hearing and to save the courts the time of having to have that hearing in cases where there's not sufficient facts alleged. And I also think, but I think that one of the other important things that the legislature did when amending the statute is they did change the language to say that a person can petition at any time. Before, a person only could petition after the reports were filed and or if the secretary could petition at any time, but they made it easier for petitioners to petition at any time, and because they can do it, I mean, they could turn around next week and file another one if it's denied, that because they made it easier to get that initial step, they then made it harder to get beyond the paper review into the hearing so that circuit courts weren't overwhelmed by these.
How many years may a person be held, be committed without a hearing?
I'm not sure the answer to that. I mean, maybe if they never...
I mean, your view is that there never has to be a hearing. If the judge looks at all these things and does it in chambers, that's enough.
My argument is related to the statute on petitions for discharge. I'm not sure if you're talking about so that, yes, there might not ever have to be a hearing on a petition for discharge. I guess I'm not sure about all the petitions for supervised release or that's not in this case. But I mean, maybe they would be able to get hearings under that. But under 89809, I think that's probably a fair reading, is that they could go years without.
Now that raises another issue. We're dealing with somebody who was committed as a juvenile.
Yes.
And there's a possibility that for the rest of this person's life, not only don't they get, they may not get a hearing, but they may be forever in as a sexually violent person for an act as a juvenile, which may raise constitutional issues which are before the United States Supreme Court in a different kind of format about what you can do with a juvenile. For an offense committed while a juvenile, and that's not before us. Also, if I might point out, although your brief discusses the constitutional issues involved in Chapter 980, which has been held constitutional by this court in similar statutes in the U.S. Supreme Court, it deals with the constitutionality of these changes in an indirect way, as does the Court of Appeals decision, which says you've got to interpret this statute in a way that you don't do potential damage to constitutionality. But no one has attacked the constitutionality of the statute directly.
Yes, in this case, I agree with that.
And I think that those are important things to remember. I think the argument is concluded in 08-AP-52, State versus Arends. And I want to thank Attorney Remington and Attorney Kaczynski for their arguments in a very difficult statutory interpretation case. And we didn't even get to the, in my mind, as difficult issue. Because if you did evaluate the reports here, one by the state that says, I don't know if he fits it or not, that's whether or not either side has met whatever the evidentiary test is here. And I assume neither one of you have given up on that argument. We just didn't get it in oral. Okay. I do want to remind everyone that today is September 11th, and that on September 11th, 2001, this country and the world suffered grievous harm. And we'd like to take a few moments of silence for those thousands who perished.